to quickly run through this morning's program. We're going to obviously eat breakfast, and please continue to help yourself to more food and coffee and everything else. We're first going to have a presentation on wills and estates. The idea is we're going to Kivrei Tzadikim today. For those who are joining us, we're going to be going to Kivrei Tzadikim today in Queens, and we thought it would be appropriate that when one goes to visit a cemetery, the point is v'achai yitein alibo, that a person should realize that our time in this world is finite, and we do whatever we're supposed to do in order to make sure that our families are cared for, in order to make sure that lachar me'ev esrim, and it should be lachar me'ev esrim and more, that that everything goes as smoothly as possible to make sure that our families are taken care of properly. So we thought it would be an appropriate time to discuss wills and estates as well as life insurance. So Mussar Chaim Dienstag is going to make a presentation on wills and estates, and then Be'ez Hashem, I'll talk a little bit about life insurance if Gershon Yarmish doesn't come, and we'll have a little bit of hopefully at least open up our eyes a little bit to what needs to be taken care of, and then Be'ez Hashem, I'll talk a little bit about visiting Kivrei Tzadikim, maybe a little bit about the Kivrei Tzadikim that we're going to be visiting today, and then Be'ez Hashem, whoever's coming, will get into their cars. And we'll meet at Mount Judah Cemetery, at the entrance of Mount Judah Cemetery. Don't drive into Mount Judah Cemetery, because once you drive in, if another car drives in behind you, you're never getting out. You park on the street over there, and we'll make the walk to the Kvarm, all the Kvarm are right near each other. But I thank everyone for coming this morning. And I thank especially Chaim Dienstag for being willing to make the presentation for us on this very important topic of wills and estates. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebbe, very much for the introduction. Thank you, everyone, very much for coming this morning. So I'll jump right into it. The three topics that I'm hoping to discuss this morning before everyone gets bored is why you need a will, halachic issues that relate to Hilchos Nachla and inheritance, and also I figured that we were going to talk about really a lot about owning life insurance and the importance of owning life insurance, thinking about your family, after 120. So the one thing, I guess in my practice I don't sell life insurance, but to consider is whether or not it pays to own your life insurance, or it's advisable to own your life insurance in a life insurance, an irrevocable life insurance trust. So we'll start with the first one. And that's just relevant in general to all, humans, especially if you have families and children, is why you need a will. So whenever we're talking about why you need a will, the first thing you talk about is why you don't need a will. So that has to do with what the will actually controls, what a will governs. So a will actually does not control, a good deal of your assets, and this includes the following. Anything that you own jointly, if it's a joint account or a jointly owned house, you own by tenants in the entirety, whatever, with your spouse, it's not controlled by the will. That would go directly to the joint tenant, the joint owner of the property, and that's usually, someone's spouse. So if there's any you have any joint property, it doesn't go by the will. Also, if you have any accounts that have beneficiaries on the accounts, usually, let's say, retirement accounts, IRAs, 401ks, if you made sure to list the beneficiary on the account, then instead of the asset going through your estate, through your will, it would go to the listed beneficiary. Usually on retirement accounts, the default is that it will go to your spouse, but unless you list a secondary beneficiary, it could go through your estate, in which case your children or whoever the beneficiary of your plan is, they would have to wait for it to go through probate. So that's, first of all, to understand what the will does not control. But any other assets that you own, whether you own it in an account that there's no beneficiary on, it's not jointly owned, if you own a piece of real estate, you own LLC interests, or you own anything like that, those are generally not, survivorship controlled by beneficiary designations, and those actually do go through your estate, and they do go through your will. So those are the things to be cognizant of when you're having a will drafted. Is the other first thing that people should know is that everyone has a will. Whether or not you've ever done a will, you have a will. And the will is based on the New York laws of state of intestacy, right? Because if you don't have a will, New York says exactly how your assets are distributed that are part of your estate. And the default laws, every state is, you know, different, but the default laws in New York are as follows. Any assets that go through your estate, the first $50,000 worth of assets goes to your spouse, and the balance is split 50-50 between your kids. Your kids will receive half the assets, and your spouse receives half the assets. Basically, you know, no one knows this because everyone thinks when most people draft wills, when they're married, first marriage, everything goes to their spouse, you know, if the spouse survives them. So this is often something that's surprising to people. And if that's not your intent, that your assets should first, you know, be split 50-50 between your kids and your spouse, then you definitely want to do to have a will in place, you know, before you pass. So that being said, wills can be, they can be simple or complex. But the idea is that no matter what, you should have at least, wills are something that you can change an infinite amount of times, and it pays to make sure that you have, you know, the people in place, that the beneficiaries named in place that you want to have in place. In addition, there's also something, the other point to having a will is that it controls who's the one that will administer the estate. There are default laws, who's the executor of the estate is, or the administrator of the estate if you don't have a will. And sometimes, you know, often it's the default beneficiaries. It could be the spouse with the kids. And therefore, if you have intent on who you want to be the executor of your estate, that's not necessarily the initial beneficiaries, or you want to have co-executors, it's also essential that you have a will for those reasons. And perhaps, not perhaps, most importantly, if you have children that are minors, perhaps the most important reason to have a will is that the will names the guardians of your estate. Now, if both parents, you know, if one parent dies, then the other parent, by default, will become the guardian of the children. If chas v'shalom, you know, both parents should pass away and there's no will, well, then it goes to the state who the conservator, who the guardian of your kids will be appointed, and that's not necessarily, you know, what you want. Now, that's usually the most contentious issue, you know, between spouses, of who's going to be the guardian of the kids, because, say, my family should be, you know, the guardians. You know, I think my family is more in line with our hashkafa. You know, I think your parents are incompetent. So you have these points back and forth. But it's important that no matter what you guys decide, you know, it'll be better than not having a decision at all. And that's the bottom line. The bottom line is everyone should have a will. You can change it as often as you want, but this way you ensure that assets go where you want them to go. The people who you want to administer the estate and be your executor are the executors. And most importantly, your kids will go, you know, at least to your first or second choice of who you want them to go to. And a will is a very flexible instrument. You can have things go into trust upon your passing, and then you can have different people, let's say, take care of your children, and different people manage the assets. And there's almost unlimited flexibility of what you can do with the trust, how long it's held there, what percentage goes out to the kids, different ages, different kids can get their assets differently. So there are a lot of benefits, you know, to having a will. Okay, so that's the part of the on the benefits to having, why you need a will. So now the other issue we talked about is halachic estate planning, the Rav discussed. And this is something that a lot of people are not aware of, that it's actually an issue, and that halacha really does control seder nachla, you know, laws of inheritance. And, you know, the classic case and the main time the Torah probably discusses hilchas nachla is the stories of Benos Slavchad. And over there, the Torah goes through laws of inheritance, almost in like a cryptic way. It starts off by saying, you know, Ish ki yamos uben ein lo v'avartim es nachasol levito. It doesn't say, like, you know, the assets go to your son. It says, if there's no boy, well, then it will pass over to go to the daughters. And v'im ein lo bas, v'nusatim es nachasol l'achiv. And if there's no daughters, it goes to your brothers. Really doesn't go to your brothers. It actually goes to your parent, your father, I should say. But if the father's not, the assumption is the father's not alive at that point, then it goes down to the brothers, and if you have no brothers, well, then it goes, you know, technically up to your grandfather, but again, Torah assumes there's no grandfather, and therefore it says it goes to your father's brothers. Basically, the concept is it goes down, and if there's no one down, then it goes up and back down again. You basically stand your children stand in your shoes. And then the pasuk says, interestingly, v'me'en lo achim la'aviv, if your father doesn't have any brothers, your estate will go to your closest relatives from your family, mishpachto, and and we know that means your father's family. The Yarash Osa, and they will inherit your estate. The Haisel of Neisrael, L'chukas Mishpat, Kashir Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. And here's the key line. It's going to be to Yisrael, L'chukas Mishpat. A chok, that's a mishpat. And normally people think of, like, mishpat, we know that, you know, dine mamonis, you know, you have dine malchus dine, and even more significantly, you can contract. You can contract around things. But a chok is obviously something that's in a halach in the Torah that is not, you know, that's not subject to change. That's not something you can make a tenai on. And this is the understanding of, you know, this is basically how we paskin. And even Gemara is very, very explicit that says that if someone says, you know, after I die, that my assets should go not in accordance with Hilchas Nachla, it has no meaning. It's worthless because you're trying to make a tenai on mashkaz b'Torah, and you can't be masna, you can't make a tenai against something that's written in the Torah. Right, you can't say you know, my kids don't have to keep kosher because you know that's what I want them to do. So this is an issue, and if everyone's compliant and everyone's an adult, meaning your wife, you know your wife is an adult, your kids are, well, obviously your wife's an adult, your wife's alive, your kids are adults and they're compliant, they can be mocho, right? Of course, if they don't want to be mocho, they don't have to be mocho. So if your son says, no, I think I should inherit my share. My mother shouldn't get everything. It's not really fair. You know, they can protest about it. More likely if the mother's passed away and there are kids, boys and girls. You know, the boys can say, no, I think I was more helpful to the family because, you know, sons obviously are much more useful children than girls, and therefore they have a right to inherit more. That's one approach, but. Even more significantly, if you have minor children can't even be mocho on the assets they're entitled to. So in either case, either if you have a child that doesn't want to be mocho, who's an adult, or you have minor children, if you were going to go by either, you know, the default laws of New York intestacy, which is, you know, it goes to the spouse and then it gets split amongst boys and girls, you know, equally, or you actually have a will, like I would say, all clients, no matter how orthodox they associate with, no one has ever said, yeah, I want my assets to go. My wife, I just want her to get the ksuva. She gets, you know, figure out what the value of the silver spot is. And then I want everything to go to my boys and my girls. You know, if they've all hit 12 and a half, you know, then they don't need to get anything. And definitely if they're married, you know, obviously. So no one ever says that. So the question is, there are real issues of Geneva here. There are some alternative opinions among the poskim whether or not, you know, Seidina Machus Seidina, I guess there are other issues, other potential ways about mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames, but I guess that's, you know, be a little complex. But most poskim say that it's a real issue, that unless you have some sort of halachic mechanism in place to effectuate what you want to do, how you want your assets to go, you really are, you know, dealing with issues of potential geneva. So the question is, you know, how do you deal with this? But I guess I should back up for a second because people say, well, you know, this doesn't really apply to me because people don't realize, even though the psukim that we just read a second ago, people think, well, you know, I don't have a bechor, so I don't have to worry about hilchos nachla because there's no firstborn boy and therefore there's no double portion. So no, there are issues in all cases because, as we just read, girls only inherit if there are no boys. If there are boys, if you have any sons, then it's an issue. In my case, I had four girls all along, and they all thought they were going to get equally, and now my son came along, and technically not entitled to anything, which actually is not a surprise to some of them because they believe he's the favorite, even though this is not true. And Avigal, if you're listening, you're wrong. I love you all equally. So that could be an issue. But that's not even true, because I really had the same issue even before my son was born, because the halacha of Hilchos Nachla are that your children inherit before your spouse. Your spouse is not entitled to any sort of inheritance. Your spouse is only entitled to the ksuva. And, I mean, it's true that, you know, until she remarries, you know, they could live off the estate, they're entitled to support. But the bottom line is, you know, it's not usually how it goes. Usually the spouse, you know, takes actual ownership. So really, no matter what the situation is, and then even if you don't have children, whatever the case is, your spouse is still not entitled to your estate. It really goes to, it says very explicitly in the pasuk, goes to your siblings or your parents. And once again, your spouse is just entitled to support and or the ksuva. So all from Jews need to have some sort of halachic mechanism to ensure that as it's passed, al pi halacha, and there's no issues of gzeila. So what are the solutions that we have in place? Because obviously there are solutions in place, as I said. No matter how orthodox my clients are, no one ever wants it to go al pi halacha straightforward. So there are a couple approaches. One simple approach that I was talking with Robert Klein about before that he mentioned is that a person could say, I'll make a gift now of all my assets, you know, as I want them to go. And I'll say the gift is I'll make a kinyan now to make the gift chal. And it'll be payable, you know, right before I die. That's when the gift will be distributed, right? So whenever it is, you basically make it tonight, that the gift should work that way. The issue with that approach, it sounds simple, it's just a, you know, kinyan sudder, a person cannot make a gift of things that they don't currently own. So unless you know exactly when you're going to, you know, right before you die to make the gift, or you, at the time when you make this gift, you never acquire any additional assets, it's not a very effective approach, because every time you gain more assets, or you inherit something, whatever it is, you would have to do this whole gift mechanism again. So it's not the most advisable approach. So I shouldn't say the simplest, but the most effective means, I think, that we have of transferring assets, you know, al pi halacha, but still as according to you want them to be transferred, is what's called, it's in English called a conditional halachic note of indebtedness. Sounds complicated, but this is what it means. It means that, again, we do a kinyan at this time to say that person figures out, you know, what their estate is, they draw up this conditional note of indebtedness, and the note basically says as follows. It says, you pick a number, let's say you think your assets are worth $1 million, you write something like this, you say, I'm accepting upon myself through this kinyan a debt of $5 million right now. It's the debt is effective now, and it's payable a moment before I die. And the debt is in favor of, usually you do it in favor of your spouse. So if I pass away, you know, I owe $5 million to my spouse. And if my spouse predeceased me, then that money will you list the successors. It would go first to your daughters. And if you just have boys, you would say it goes to the younger boys instead of the bechor. So what does this do? So we know, or we don't know, that al pi halacha, when you inherit your father, your mother's estate, you don't just inherit the assets they have. You also inherit the debts, the debt that they have that they owe during their lifetime. You don't get to wipe out. It's not like claiming bankruptcy al pi halacha when you die. Your kids, they don't just get the assets. They get the assets subject to the liabilities that were on them during your lifetime. And therefore, the kids would get, you know, your halachic heirs can say, yeah, I want to get the estate, and I'm going to collect the estate. And they say, I'm going to go to Bezin to enforce this. I don't want to deal with, you know, New York laws of intestacy. I don't want to deal with the will. So they say, go to Bezin. They say, I want the estate. And Bezin will say, you're right. You're entitled to it. But the estate is worth $2 million. And your father wrote that if, you know, when he dies, that you have to pay $5 million. It's going to wipe out the entire estate. But there's an additional aspect to the, it's called the conditional halachic note of debtedness. Why is it conditional? Because the note always says it's conditioned that if my halachic heirs should adhere to what I write in my will or in the other means of assets transferring upon my death, as revocable trust or survivorship accounts or any other means, if they adhere to it, then the debt is batal. And the debt is, and it's a complex note. It says, you know, if some heirs adhere to it, then it's batal with respect to them. If other heirs don't adhere to it, then the obligation remains on them. And by doing this mechanism, you enforce the will. And it works even if a minor, right? Because, I mean, it's basically, even if a minor doesn't have das, you know, to effectuate this transfer, they're saying, okay, I'm going to give this up because I don't want to have this full debt. This is like zachan adam shelo b'fanav, that obviously you'd rather have no money than have a debt larger than the assets that you're receiving. So this is basically the go-to method that probably even some non-from estate planners know about this, that in order to ensure that assets go how the testator, the person who writes the will, has them go, but they don't have issues of gneva, you know, with respect to the halachic heirs, This is the mechanism that is in place. Okay, so that is our first two topics, and the third topic is, life insurance. I was going to talk about life insurance trust, but I guess the Rav will talk about situations where you have life that the Rav knows about personally. When you have life insurance, when you don't have life insurance, you can see the differences. But it's just for, yes.
What about the issue of Bechor having double rates?
So you're asking.
If you have a Bechor.
Right.
So if your rights are like supposed to give.
Mm-hmm. So it's the same concept. The nature of a Bechor's double portion, the way it's inheritance, is slightly different than let's say what the other ways inheritance work, you know, Muchsak versus Roy. But the idea is the same, that it's just like the Bechor. He's right, he's entitled to his double portion. When I said he can go to Bezin to enforce it, you know, let's say you have two boys and five girls, whatever it is. And the boy is a Bechor. So the Bechor says, I want 2/3 of the estate because I'm entitled to it. And the other boy says, I want 1/3 of the estate because that's what I'm entitled to. And the girls are getting nothing. And once again, Bezin will say, you're right. You're entitled to 2/3 and you're entitled to 1/3. 100% correct. Unfortunately, the estate is worth less than the debt that you now owe based on this halachic conditional note of indebtedness that your father signed before he passed away. I guess I shouldn't. So it works the same way. I guess I should back up to the halachic aspect first. So although, people forget about this also, although women do not have bechors, right, there's no halachic aspect of bechor for women, they do have hilchos yerusha as well. And just like for a man that his sons inherit him exclusively, so too for a woman. Her sons inherit her exclusively as well. And therefore, if she dies without boys and girls, then she survives her husband. I guess I should mention, the husband inherits the wife. So it's not an issue, I guess, if the wife is leaving everything to the husband, then you don't really have to worry about anything. We'll get to in a second what happens if the wife wants to leave something to someone not her husband. We'll talk about it in a second. But a wife will need, just like we talked about a halakhic conditional note of indebtedness for a man has to do, so to a wife has to do it because she'll have the exact same issues of Yerusha. Of the assets going not equally to the children, but just to the boys. So I'm remiss if I don't mention that a woman needs a halakhic will, just like a man needs a halakhic will. Now, I guess we should talk about what happens if the wife wants to actually leave something, anything, usually jewelry or whatnot, to her daughters. That she doesn't want everything to go to her husband, which is, the halakha. I think it's Midr Rabbanan for Mishum Eva. But let's say that's how we hold the halacha. So let's say the wife wants to say, I'm going to leave something to my daughters. So the issue is, well, can't she just do the same debt trick against her husband? So the answer is no, you can't. And the reason is, why doesn't that work? Is because the husband is considered the first creditor of the wife's estate. For example, if the wife has an asset, Nechlem Alug, and she wants to sell this asset during her lifetime, really what she's doing is she's just giving a life estate to the person who purchases it. And after she passes away, the husband's able to reclaim the assets because the husband is considered the wife's first creditor on all the assets that she owns. So the way around this, actually, and this is especially important if it's like a second marriage, because usually there, or oftentimes a wife does not want to leave everything to her first husband if she has kids from a first marriage. So the question is, what do you do in that case? So the answer for that is there's something called conditional halakhic note of indebtedness, and where the husband also, in addition to the wife obligating herself to her non-halakhic heirs, the husband will also indebt himself to the individuals that he wants his wife to inherit. And he'll say as follows, if I do not adhere to what my wife wants $100,000 to go, whatever the number is to her, let's say her children from the first marriage, if I do not adhere to what my wife says in her will, I'm mechayev myself a sum greater than the amount that I would inherit from my wife if I would enforce my halachic rights. So the truth is, if there are two spouses, usually you have, if the wife wants any assets not to go to the husband, you really do three documents. You really do the husband will do two. He'll do one for his estate. He'll do one to allow his wife's estate to go to her heirs. And the wife will just do a standard luck note indebtedness, And I mentioned that at the beginning, but I should say at the end, the way that the Lachnun Adenonis is a somewhat complex document because it's conditional and there are various aspects to it, and many Rabbanim and lawyers have gone together and drafted it rather well to have multiple luck mechanisms to ensure that it's effective. But the idea is, think of it almost, it sounds like a workaround, that you're getting around Hilchos Nachla, by just doing a kinyan. It's kind of similar to we say, like selling chametz, so to speak, where you really do, but I would say it's okay, I'm not going to judge what I think is... whatever. If you don't have a problem selling chametz, you certainly should not have a problem doing this. So what's that? Fair?
You are going to judge.
What's that?
So you are going to judge.
I am going to judge. I'm not going to judge, but I'm going to judge. So the idea is you're doing a kinyan that's now with the kinyan sutta that's chal, and it's a real halachic thing. I guess I should mention that if I'm going to say that this is less of an issue than selling chametz, there is an issue of mavir nachla, which is the idea that it's true that you can do this kinyan that allows your assets to go as you want them to go, but usually there is an idea of being mavir nachla, and one should not be mavir nachla. The Gemara is very very strong in the language in Bava Basra in the 8th parak. It starts off that even if someone's son is not a good guy, he still should try to not skip over the son, and you should still adhere to Hilchos Nachla. So usually you set aside a certain sum of assets that you say in your will. So this is actually in the secular. Well, the halachic will is a totally separate document. You can execute it once. You never have to execute it again. You just keep redoing your will. The halachic will is a halachic conditional note of indebtedness. It remains effective. But oftentimes what we do is, or usually what we do for from clients, is that we'll advise that inside their will itself, they should set aside a certain sum or certain types of property that they say that should transfer al pi halacha, al seder nachla, and it should be a davar chashav, it should be not a de minimis amount, and therefore you have less of an issue with being mavir nachla, with writing out your halachic heirs. Okay, so now that I think we've covered everything I want to cover in the halachic estate planning area, so now moving on to life insurance. So so again, like we were saying before, it's Avishai Neumann gets credit with pushing this morning, this speech this morning, because unfortunately we recently had an incident in the neighborhood where someone who was very young, in their early 30s, passed away without life insurance. Or not enough life insurance. I don't know the details, but I do know that there was a big push to raise a substantial sum of money to help pay for his family's needs. And even though it seems like it was a substantial sum of money that people actually had to over between $500,000 and $1 million, or I don't know what was ultimately raised, that's a lot of money to come up with to help out this family. Of course, this person was in reasonably good health, probably paying $1,000 to $1,500 a year would have got his family more money than all the money that the community raised together for this person, Lil Leno. So the idea is that I know no one likes to think about everything I'm talking about is talking about death. We're also talking about life insurance. Obviously has to do with death, but the idea is that we're talking about this time of year because not just going to the cemetery, but even if you're not going to go to the Kivrei Tzaddikim, this is a time that everyone reflects on their mortality. Everyone knows that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, your life is being judged, and whether or not you're going to live another year. And therefore, this is probably the most appropriate time for people to reflect and say, is my family taken care of? Do I have a will? Do I have life insurance? These things are very, very important to consider always. And this time of year, while we're thinking about them in general, we should definitely, pay extra heed to these issues. So just briefly, life insurance trust. There are two main issues for the life insurance trust. One is we said initially that the life insurance, I don't know if we mentioned life insurance is one of the assets that don't go through your will. But as long as you, yes, we did. As long as you name one benefit, I don't know. You go back to the tape. As long as we name one beneficiary on your life insurance policy, the life insurance policy will not go through your estate. It will go to the beneficiaries. If you name your spouse, then she doesn't have to wait for the will to be probated. She gets the money. If you name it to your, you know, if you have your kids as a secondary beneficiary, your spouse is not alive, then it goes, you know, to your kids. Usually you say in equal shares. But the reason to consider, so it doesn't go through the will. So why would you own the life insurance policy in a trust as opposed to through the will? And the reason is because life insurance is usually, especially for younger people, it could be their most significant asset that they have upon their death. You know, you can imagine someone who has an estate, you know, of $1 million, but has life insurance of $3 million, and they might say that, you know, I want my spouse to be taken care of, but I want the assets to be managed perhaps by someone, you know, a second party or another party to assist in the management of the assets. And therefore, if you have life insurance in a trust, you can control how much goes outright, how much remains in trust for income and needs during the lifetime, and then at some later point, it can be distributed, you know, amongst your children. So basically, the reason to have life, if you have life insurance and it goes outright to the beneficiary, you have no control over how those monies are spent, how those monies are used. If it's in a trust, then you have, like, any powers that one retains over a trust in how it's the assets are disposed of, you would have over the life insurance policy as well. The other benefit to having life insurance policy is for estate planning tax purposes. People know that life insurance is not subject to income tax, which is, you know, a big deal, which makes the a life insurance policy worth a lot more than you would think on its face, because income can be subject to substantial taxes. Nevertheless, if you own life insurance outright, in your personal name, it can be subject to estate taxes. Currently, this is not something that most people have to worry about because the exemption is so high. There are a lot of Democrats in control right now, so the understanding in the estate planning world is that exemptions are going to go down significantly, and many more people are going to have to worry about estate taxes, but that's a discussion for another time. That's all. Okay. Any questions? Yes. Yes.
So what stops the wife or the daughter from saying, let's keep it that way? I'd like to collect.
It sounds, especially for the daughters, because usually the daughters, they're getting only a pro rata share of the estate. If they get the debt, then they get a lot more than they get the whole estate. So definitely. So again, so the reason is it's called the conditional note of indebtedness because the debt, even though you can't be masna masha kasa b'Torah, you can't make a t'nai against what's written in the Torah, you can make unlimited conditions on documents that you draft up yourself, and the documents provide that the debt is batal, that the debt is nullified, provided my child listens to what it says. If my halachic heirs adhere to what it says in my will, they adhere to the rules of survivorship on estates and houses, and therefore the debt will be completely null and void if the heirs adhere to what the dictates are in my secular documents. So that's why they don't have the option is with the halachic heir, not with the daughter or the spouse. That's who controls it. Yes?
Once you put a trust in place, is there any paperwork that's done annually or like once it's done, it's done?
Good question.
You can update a will often.
Right. So what we talked about for the life insurance trust to work for definitely from an estate tax standpoint, it has to be a completely irrevocable trust, and which means that you can't take it back, you can't unwind it, and there's certain things that the trust needs to have built into it to ensure that it accomplishes its goal, which is to keep it out of your estate, but. I guess one question is: What would you have to do annually to maintain a trust? There's no filings with the state on an annual basis to record the trust. I guess I should say back up one step before we talk about annually. Initially, what do you have to do? So, if you want the trust to be the owner and the beneficiary of a policy, you have to initially the person who's the owner. The owner is the insured, the person who purchased the policy against their life. The beneficiaries are whoever they name. So if you already have insurance policies in place and you set up a trust, you actually have to go through the paperwork of transferring ownership of the policy to the trust, which means the trust irrevocably owns the policy. And then you also have to, you know, the trustees would have to go and change the beneficiaries on the policy, usually to the trust, or always to the trust. So there is paperwork involved initially. On an annual basis, there's while the insured is alive, there's no tax filings or anything, because by their inherent nature, they're grantor trusts, which means that even though they're a real gift and they don't belong to you, the taxes are paid by the grantor, the one who set up the trust, which is also the insured. After 120 and someone passes away, that trust will, you know, presumably you have it there to be maintained for some time. At that point, you'll have to the trustees will have to file annual tax returns for the trust. So there will be annual maintenance fees involved, but they'll be, you know, the idea is that those maintenance fees are much smaller, you know, much smaller than the value of the trust and the benefits that you have by having it in trust. If you don't put in the trust and you have a taxable estate, then it's again, it's there's no income tax on it, but the entire value of the policy is inside your estate. So they're currently talking about dropping down the lifetime exemption. It's currently at $11.7 million per spouse. They're talking about having a drop down. It automatically drops in half in 2020 at the end of 2025, 2026. But right now, the current proposals on almost all of the many tax proposals by Democratic senators, you know, are to lower the exemption. Probably about $3.5 million. So you can imagine that your house is part of your estate, and your retirement plan is part of your estate, and your insurance, the proceeds from the life insurance policy are part of your estate. So it's very easy to see that a situation where a person, even though they don't consider themselves to have a lot of money, could easily have a taxable estate. And state tax rates currently start at 40% federally, and if New York, they go up to 16%, but basically think of it as a 50% tax, which sounds ridiculous, and it is.
No judgment.
No, I didn't even say I wasn't going to judge that. That we could judge. Any other questions? Okay, thank you everyone. Thank you everyone very much for coming.
Thank you. Okay, I do want to make sure that we are out of here by 10:30, so that there are a number of people who are, for those of us who are going to the Kibbutz Tzaddikim, who are meeting us at Mount Judah, and I told them to meet us at the entrance at 11 o'clock. So just maybe a quick word about life insurance. And I don't know anything about life insurance, I'll tell you that. The person that should be presenting is probably Albert Kahn. If you know Avi Kahn's father, Albert Kahn, if you've ever met him, then you know that he's very concerned that you and your wife and all your children should have life life insurance, that as soon as a person is married, they should have adequate life insurance. And he's made it his life's mission. He doesn't make a living doing this. He's made it his life's mission. And he called me the other day and really told me how strongly we need to push this. And just to give you a sense, you know, I've been unfortunately involved had a front row seat in several situations where people unexpectedly died young. And the difference between a situation where someone who has adequate life insurance and someone who doesn't have adequate life insurance is enormous. Not only in terms of how well the family is going to be taken care of, and not only in terms of the family's sense of relief that they can mourn the loss and not have to worry about other things, but even in the way, and I hesitate to say this, but even in the way that they look at the deceased. Meaning, when you hear, I'll give an example. Many of you may know Rabbi Yanky Horowitz. Rabbi Yanky Horowitz is a very, very chash of a person, and is in the world of chinuch. He lost his father at a very young age. And when he talks about his father is a hero. Why? Because when his father died, he left adequate life insurance for the family. And that opens him up, because he saw that his father made sure to take care of his family. So it opened up to all of the messages and all of the teachings that his father had to be able to look at it in an unbiased and a clear way, to be able to have a starting point that this person is a tzaddik. I unfortunately, very often, if someone does not take care of their family, they may not say it straight out, and they may say it straight out sometimes, just not in public, there is a sense of resentment. There's how could they leave us like this? How could they abandon us like this? And it's you know, it's our responsibility to make sure that our families, just like it's our responsibility now while we're alive, it's our responsibility to make sure that our families are cared for. And I can tell you from a communal perspective, it's so much more dignified to raise the money to pay for someone's life insurance policy if they can't afford it than it is to raise the money to raise an exorbitant sum of money after they die, which will still be maybe half of what they could have gotten, or probably less than half of what they could have gotten from a life insurance policy. And you know, that people should be on the GoFundMe, that people should have to be, you know, that a family should have to go through that indignity. It should never happen. Albert Kahn said, if there's anyone that can't afford life insurance, he'd rather raise the money for the life insurance policy. It'll be much easier for him to do that now rather than have to raise the money later. In fact, someone pointed out to him that he is probably the biggest fundraiser in Klal Yisrael in the last 2 years, because unfortunately so many people died of COVID, and while you saw all of these pages going up to raise money, how many pages didn't go up because people had life insurance? And if someone pushed those people to get life insurance, and that's what caused them to have a $2 million policy, $3 million policy, where they didn't have to say, let's try to raise $750,000 and then hope for the best. That's significant funds. One should be aware, it's important also not only for us, but for our wives to have life insurance as well, particularly if your wife is working. And very often, a person says, oh, I have life insurance. When I got married, I was responsible, and right away, as soon as I got married, I got a life insurance policy. I don't know about you, but my hasagos of what it costs to live when I got married are very, very different than they are now. Like, if when I got married, someone would have said, you'll have $250,000 of life insurance. I was like, $250,000? That's amazing. I was like making $25,000 a year in DRS at the time. That's 10 years salary. So, and that changes over the, thank God, that changes over the course of time. So a lot of us have life insurance from a long time ago, and it's important to update and make sure that we have adequate life insurance. So we have to ask ourselves, do we have enough? Obviously, you know, there was some discussion whether we should have a life insurance salesman, come and speak. Some people said, no, he's no gabadover. He's just trying to drum up business. If you have someone like that, come and speak. Which, by the way, there's nothing wrong with doing that in a shul. The Gemara Maseches Sukkah says that the base Knesset of Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim, they dafka sat based on profession so that they could help each other out in the profession. So if there's a frum guy that sells life insurance and you can help him out, nothing so bad about doing that through a shul. Okay, you know, but whatever it is, for whatever reason, that was decided. But if you don't know who to go to, if you don't know people, first of all, you do. But if you don't, there are several people within our community, from people within our community, that can talk you through it. Clearly, it seems that term life insurance is the way to go, and at least to get you to the point where your kids are adults, to get to that point. Now, from a halachic perspective, there are three major arguments that people make against life insurance. None of them really carry any weight. There are those that say, well, al yiftach peh le-satan. You shouldn't open your mouth to the satan. So by buying life insurance, you're acknowledging that you're going to die. I mean, I have news for you. it's not a violation of al yiftach peh le-satan. Again, we don't have time right now to go through all of the details. Why not? The other argument is that bitachon, a person has to have bitachon. So there's no din that you have to have bitachon that you're never going to die. There's no such din. Rav Moshe writes in the Tshuva that adrabah, we view life insurance as a business investment, and just like it's not a violation of bitachon to work for a living, it's not a violation of bitachon to make this investment that is very, very worthwhile. And then there are those that argue that no, the problem is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's judgment is absolutely correct and pure. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never make someone suffer if they don't deserve to suffer. So I know that I'm a terrible person. So I might deserve to suffer. But my wife is a tzaddikah. She doesn't deserve to suffer. But if I buy life insurance, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to punish me because it doesn't have any negative effect on her, because she's going to be, you know, swimming in cash, you know, if I have life insurance. But now, if I don't have life insurance, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to make something terrible happen to her that she's going to be destitute almana. So that's why you shouldn't buy life insurance. Such a cheshbon that people have. Do I have to address that cheshbon? I mean, one of the poskim says, no, adraba. You know, there's a mazel that the life insurance companies all have a mazel that they're very rich, that they make a lot of money. So if you were to buy life insurance and lo aleinu, a person were to suffer an early demise, that would take away the money from the life insurance company. But they have a mazel that they're always going to be rich. So you buy life insurance and it's a good bet that you'll make it. Whatever the cheshbonos are, all the poskim that discuss the issue, Ramosh obviously has the landmark tshuva on the topic, but all the poskim that discuss the issue strongly encourage it. It's a davar pashut, that it's something to be strongly encouraged and something that we should take care of. So we're going to leave the life insurance discussion over there, but again, by the end of Asar Simei Tshuva, we should try to put these things in order. I got to give you a call about wills. I don't have will. But we should try to put these things in order. This should be a Kabbalah that we make upon ourselves.